KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. The buzzword sustainable has been around for years, so long that it's nearly begun to lose its meaning. In order to chart a true sustainable future, we need to make changes to our lifestyles that are more drastic than simply composting or bringing reusable bags to the grocery store. This is the argument of Eric Asadorian and Annie Leonard. They're the co-authors of the book State of the World 2013. Is sustainability still possible? They spoke at Town Hall on September 16th. The talk was moderated by Grist founder Chip Giller.
Hey, everybody, and just welcome to you all. Thank you guys for coming out for this evening. So we're here tonight to talk about sustainability. And the people that will be joining me on the stage, the Dynamic Duo, have just published a book that asks some hard questions about the world we live in, about our role in creating a better future, about whether it's too late and we're all screwed. So I spend a lot of time in my day job thinking about this stuff. As we said, I founded this news site in town, grist.org. And over the past year or so, our audience has doubled, growing from 1 million to 2 million folks a month. And it's just exciting to see the interest spread in these issues. I think we had about 100 users a month when we started. And the environment at that time was thought of as kind of the Birkenstocks movement and tree hugging. And I started Grist to help kind of fight back against these stereotypes of the self-righteous scold as an environmentalist. Now, in my mind, the environment is more broadly defined. The movement's attracting a wider array of participants. And it even has a catchy name, sustainability. But is the sustainability movement enough? In some ways, we're facing the same challenges. Major problems persist. Climate change, ocean acidification, loss of biodiversity. New problems are emerging. The fracking challenge. We have to fend off coal export stuff here in the Pacific Northwest. As we all know, there's like a lack of political will often on these issues. And a lot of people just have trouble connecting on these topics because they're more focused reasonably on economy, jobs, health, and stuff like that just feels more important. But in truth, these issues are all connected. Without a healthy planet, there's no us. Without foresight, planning, commitment to change, the problems will just get worse. And we'll just keep barreling down this road to doom. So I really believe there are reasons for hope. At Grist, we're writing about them each and every day. There's a whole kind of birth of a sustainable food movement. Cities are rethinking transportation. There's been a huge growth in the renewables industry and other clean technologies, and we need a lot more of that. And so what we wanted to talk about tonight are these topics and the role that each of you can play. So let me introduce our panelists, and they really are a dynamic duo, so I'm excited to welcome them to the stage. Eric Asadorian is the author of the book State of the World 2013, Is Sustainability Still Possible? In addition to co-directing this project at World Watch, he runs a bunch of other projects, and in his spare time, he likes to blog about his toddler and raising a kid in this crazy, mixed-up world. Annie Leonard, why don't you guys come out as I make these introductions? This is just a little too mysterious. So many of you will recognize Annie from her starring celebrity role in the Story of Stuff video and the additional video she's gone on to help produce.
Thank you.
Annie's a dear friend, and she just has a long history of fighting toxic pollution, raising citizen awareness, and pushing for systemic change with organizations like Greenpeace and Healthcare Without Harm. A little-known factor, perhaps known to some people in the room, is Annie is a native Pacific Northwesterner, so we're so excited to have you here, Annie. So I will sit down, but I will awkwardly ask the first question from this perch up here. And so, you guys, I will ask questions. I'll lead a conversation for about 40 minutes, then we'll open it up to you guys on the floor. You can line up at the mics if you have questions, and we'll leave enough time for informal discussion and signing books at the end. So my first question is... The point of this book, State of the World 2013, is really to closely examine the concept of sustainability. So I'm wondering if each of you could just kick things off by defining in one sentence, pithily, what sustainability means to you. I'll start with Eric because you're the expert.
All right, one sentence.
Yeah, that's the sound.
Sustainability means sustaining or continuing human civilization or high quality lifestyles, meaning not high consumption levels, but actual well-being, without undermining the long-term planet, the long-term well-being of the planet. It's kind of the boring answer.
No, be solid. That was one sentence. It was one sentence.
That's one of the inherent dangers of talking about sustainability. It gets wonky fast. My one answer is figuring out how to live on this one magnificent planet we have in a way that is more healthy, more fair, and more fun than we're doing now.
Got
See
it.
Who does the videos and who does the writing of reports.
Exactly. So so one thing I was interested, Eric, as I read through the book is part of what State of the World talks about is about the risks of too much, you termed it, sustainababble, which I thought was a great term, and I'm hoping it doesn't apply to tonight. But is there sometimes like an upside to sustainababble, and doesn't the concept have to catch on culturally to take hold in the popular imagination? So maybe you could talk about that term and then what your concerns are and what you see about that.
Sure. I think sustainababble came up. In fact, that was the working title of the report for a while, but wanting optimism, wanting positivity, and wanting an open-ended conversation, we kind of leaned towards putting that at the beginning of the first chapter. Beyond sustainababble is this chapter by our president, Bob Engelman. And he's raising this question of how much of sustainability is actually just greenwashing. It's corporate speak, even within the nonprofit community. I mean, we have a desire to share positive stories and often give fair and balanced coverage of those little stories with the dark statistics and kind of confusing how far from sustainability we really are. So really, Bob, in his chapter, really looks at these questions of what is sustainability? What is sustainababble? How do we get to true sustainability? And the whole opening section really is trying to dig into this question of what does true sustainability look like? And it's far from what we're talking about in almost all forums. One of my favorite chapters is chapter 4 on getting to a one-planet lifestyle or getting to one-planet living, where there's a figure in there that just maps out how far we have to go from a three-planet lifestyle. And Americans have a four-planet lifestyle, so we're even off the chart. But to a one-planet lifestyle, and one-planet lifestyle means a quarter of the meat consumption, 20 kilograms a year, not 80, maybe 100 miles a year flying on average, 0.004 cars per individual. In a one-planet lifestyle. That means, for a population of Seattle, about 2,500 cars. So if you do the math, what we're talking about is fire trucks, ambulances, police cars, some buses, delivery vehicles, and maybe a small taxi fleet. But really, sustainability means no private car ownership, radical differences from where we are today to what true sustainability is. So we're trying to really reveal not just what sustainability has, how far we have to go to get sustainability, but then also obviously offer solutions on how to get there, and also an honest conversation about what if we're too late to get to a kind of a sustainable future without major ecological disruptions. How do we get ready for those disruptions and preserve some of the institutions that really we want to save? Democracy, abolition of slavery, if it gets really bad, women's equality and all these other things that we assume are progress and permanent, but perhaps aren't.
What does a sustainable future look like to you, Annie?
A sustainable future, if you just look...
Sorry.
No problem. I thought you said Eric.
We'll get back to you. Don't worry, man.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, sustainable future, to me, a big part of it is that we will be using less stuff overall. I mean, right now we're just simply using less stuff. We'll also be using less toxic stuff. So that stuff that we do use will be more compatible with biological systems, so it won't be contaminating us in the environment. We also won't be turning to stuff to meet all the emotional and social needs. We'll replace that search for identity that so many of us, not in this room, but so many people out there, find their search for identity through like the logo on their shirt or the kind of car that they own. We'll be turning to each other to meet our material needs, to meet our social needs, instead of relying on stuff. So we'll use less stuff, we'll use less toxic stuff, and we'll share it much more equitably than we share it today.
So I mean, I think I hear it in your voice, but what are you most excited about this future?
I'm excited that it's going to be fun, and it's going to be hard, and we are going to definitely have to give up some things. But the good parts of society, the richness that comes from human interaction, the things that provide the most meaningful happiness in life, that's what we're going to have more of. If you actually look at this fascinating field about happiness studies, the things that most contribute to a sense of lasting happiness is not a new flat screen TV or a new iPhone or a new car, even if it's a Prius. It's none of that stuff. The things that most contribute to happiness, and I think this will resonate with you when you think about your own life, are things like having a sense of meaning and purpose in your life, having social fabric and friends, having leisure time, and the act of working together with others towards shared goals. All of those things are what we're going to need way more of to figure out how to live sustainably, and all of those things contribute to human happiness. So I think that's really hopeful. I mean, isn't it great that the very thing that we need to do to figure out how to live on this planet is also that thing which is most fun? I mean, it's not even a bummer. It's like, we don't even have to be like, come over here and we'll be eco-martyrs and eat cardboard-tasting veggie burgers and nag each other for not bringing their bags to the store. It's about come over here and we will rebuild a sense of community and social fabric, figure out how to live sustainably, and have way more fun in the process. So what is not to like about getting on board this program?
So Eric, I'm wondering, we'll get to some of the sobering stuff in a bit, but what are you most excited about or curious about in this more sustainable future?
This one's to me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I don't want to interrupt. What am I most interested
excited and curious about?
I mean, I think the scale of change that is required, I am hopeful that we do recognize, I mean, the changes that I've made that are, you know, sustainable. I mean, we cook more and we don't go out as much. I mean, it's healthier, it's more enjoyable, it's slower, which I think is actually a real joy. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the fact that I've kind of shortened my working hours so that I have more time to play with my son and take care of my own son rather than having to outsource his development to a low-income worker, I mean, that's joyful and happy. And a good future. And I think there will be more of that. And I'm excited about that. I also think that it is going to be hard, as Annie just noted, and in some ways very, very hard, even harder than we want to believe. I mean, I think our future is once again agrarian. We'll kind of, a lot of the consumer jobs that give us livelihood will kind of erode and evaporate as the kind of the energy systems or fossil fuels kind of need to stay in the ground, either because we choose it smartly or because the systems are unraveling, environmental systems are unraveling. So a lot more of us will live extremely local lives, and making a living out of bartering and exchanging and growing some of our own food and cobbling together a livelihood through at a much smaller, reduced consumption footprint.
So that must be the curious category.
Yeah. Curious category. I mean, it's a challenge how it will look in the end.
Eric Ossadorian and Annie Leonard, the co-authors of the book State of the World 2013, Is Sustainability Still Possible? They spoke at Town Hall on September 16th. The talk was moderated by Grist founder Chip Giller. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of the talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at KUOW Speakers. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Eric Ossadorian and Annie Leonard in a moment. 920-94.9 KUOW. It's October, Breast Cancer Awareness Month. The Pink Ribbon campaign has generated millions of dollars for breast cancer awareness, but critics say the symbol benefits companies more than the campaign against breast cancer. Dr. Samantha King says it's difficult to track the money raised for breast cancer research. She's the director of Queen's University School of Kinesiology and Health Studies and the author of Pink Ribbons, Inc., Breast Cancer and the Politics of Philanthropy. We'll talk with her tomorrow in the noon hour. Also tomorrow afternoon, some observers say much of that money being raised for breast cancer research benefits corporations more than the research effort. We'll talk about that with Carrie Glasscock, Director of Corporate Relations at Komen for the Cure. That'll be at 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Forecast for the Seattle area tonight, lows in the 40s, partly cloudy this evening, then becoming mostly clear. Friday highs lower to mid-60s, areas of fog in the morning, otherwise sunny skies.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Eric Ossadorian is a senior fellow at World Watch Institute. Annie Leonard is a sustainability proponent and the creator of The Story of Stuff. The two are co-authors of the book State of the World 2013. Is sustainability still possible? They spoke at Town Hall on September 16th, and the talk was moderated by Grist founder Chip Giller.
So Annie, to your chapter in the book, I mean, consumption is a part of this challenge and something that needs to be addressed. And in reading through your chapter, I mean, what you stress is that we get lots of messages telling us to recycle or carry our own bags, to reduce our personal consumption. But these seem like pretty small acts compared to the enormity of climate change. Is consuming less better? Is it more ethical? I mean, talk to us about your chapter and your conclusions.
Sure. My chapter is called Moving from Individual Change to Broader Societal Change, or something similar to that. I forgot exactly. And I wrote the chapter in response to some ongoing discourse I'd had with people who'd seen the Story of Stuff film. Is after the film came out, we got millions of emails from people who saw the film and wrote and said, what can I do? And I was so excited. People were asking what they could do. So I started answering about join this campaign and join this organization and start a group and all these things. But the questions just kept coming. And also at live talks, is that people would raise their hand and say, what can I do? And so I got curious why they kept asking me what they could do when there are almost an infinite number of ways that we can each get involved in making the world more sustainable. So I turned it around and started asking them, well, what can you think of doing? Because I was just curious where people's heads were. And the answers I got back were so consistent all across this country. I have been traveling to churches and schools and conferences. What I heard over and over were people said, I can ride my bike instead of drive. I can carry my own bag to the store. I can stop buying bottled water. I can recycle. I can compost. If you're in Seattle, you said I can compost. Some people haven't quite gotten that yet. But all these things about I, and it was all about difference in purchasing habits or minor lifestyle adjustments. And while this was happening, I was reading this series of books called Parting the Waters, you know, it's a series of books like this high, that's a history of the civil rights movement in excruciating detail. And I was just comparing the scale of the response and what people were willing to do facing these two different challenges. And I started to realize in talking to all these people who were saying, I can carry my own bag, I can compost, which I totally think are great things to do, and I do all of those. But I started to realize that we were limiting our effectiveness, that we were responding to these huge challenges with our consumer self rather than our citizen self. So I've come up with this metaphor that we have two different muscles. We have a consumer muscle and a citizen muscle. And that consumer muscle is spoken to and validated and nurtured so much. It's the primary way that we are called upon to engage with each other. I mean, so much that lots of media uses the word human being and consumer interchangeably as though that is our primary identity. And so the consumer muscle is overdeveloped. And meanwhile, our citizen muscle has atrophied because we are not called upon to use it. So when we are faced with problems as enormous as disruption of the global climate, as enormous as babies being born pre-polluted with already 260 industrial chemicals in the blood of brand new babies. I mean, these are really huge problems. And the best that we can think of doing is carrying our own bag to the grocery store. And so I have now on this mission to get people to, of course, course do all those things, but don't see that as a civic response to the environmental calamities that we are facing. I like to think of those things as responsible adult hygiene. It's like you floss your teeth, you carry your own bag to the store, you wash your hands after you use the toilet, you ride your bike. Like, those are sort of basic adult functioning. If we really want to have a response that's commensurate with the scale of the problem, we've got to move out of this perfecting our individual lifestyles, trying to be like eco-perfectionists within this fundamental system set up to not be environmental. We've got to work together as citizens. You know, citizen engagement is inherently collective. We've got to work together as citizens to change the context rather than perfect our choices from a flawed menu. So that's what this article is about. Sorry, that was long.
Annie, I thought I was just as like an anecdote, an interesting one that, and I had forgotten this, that one of the first public commercials that kind of set off or helped to establish the modern day environmental movement, the one with the Native American crying after canoeing through the trash, that was funded by industry.
Well, first of all, he was an Italian dressed up as a Native American.
Right.
I know that's shocking to all of us who that commercial really imprinted on a whole generation. You remember the crying fake Indian? You guys remember that? So that commercial was funded by an organization created by users of single-use disposable food packaging. Coke, Pepsi, a bunch of these companies. It was right in the 1970s when there was a lot of concern about pollution. And so they got together, they made this organization called Keep America Beautiful. And their idea was to convince us that we were the reason that there was pollution. So they even coined the term litter bug, like it's our fault. Now, I totally remember watching that commercial, and I remember I was like in grade school, I said, I'm going to pick up every piece of litter on the way to school tomorrow. And I did, and then the next day there was more, and I'm like, I'm going to pick up every piece of litter on the school. And so what that commercial, you can go back and watch it on YouTube, it is so insidious. It ends after zooms in on the fake Indian's tear, and it says, people start pollution. People can stop it. And I said, no, actually, multinational beverage companies who use single-serving disposable packaging cause pollution, and citizens can stop it. So it was part of this effort, what we call the individualization, making us think that there is global warming because you drove to work, and there is a water crisis because you left the water on while you were brushing your teeth. And we need to not buy that crap and say it is a systemic problem, and we have to work together to change that system.
So, speaking of buying crap, just to do a little interlude question here. As we talk about this future where we are consuming less, and yes, it's not individual action that's going to cause all this change, but is there anything that you guys, it's going to be hard for you guys to give up? What is something that's going to be difficult for you guys to give up that you'll need to give up? Start with you, Eric.
Okay. George Monbiot, we were talking about this earlier, he mentioned the idea of love miles. I mean, until we can't fly anymore because it's just priced out of most of our opportunity, I think most people will continue to try to fly to see their family. I would give up in a second work travel, I have to admit. Even here, I mean, the culture could easily change where you've got three screens here. Where the three of us are actually one local, so maybe you would be moderating two screens. And that could probably work, and if there was no opportunity to fly, we could probably do that. But love miles are probably the most challenging. I have to admit, my mother-in-law came and helped raise our son for 3 months, and it's wonderful to bond with a person who you actually can't even have a conversation with because we don't have a shared language. But we got along wonderfully, and she was such a help. But thinking about her carbon emissions from Ashgabat, Turkmenistan, still makes me feel very guilty. So probably flying.
Love miles. Yeah.
Love miles.
Annie?
I think flying is a big one, not just to see family, but to see all the people around the world that are working for a better solution and a better future. So often people ask me, how do I stay so optimistic in spite of the incredible grim evidence, which definitely does not merit the level of optimism I have. And the way that I stay so optimistic is going all over the country and sometimes internationally to meet people. Everywhere you go, there are people that are working together for a better future. Everywhere I go, I see people that are bringing back organic food, that are integrating environmental curricula into education, the transition town movement, the organic food movement. I mean, it's just, there's so many solutionaries all over, and seeing them with my own eyes feeds my soul in a way that I have never found anything else that does it. So I'll miss that. It's not the same as reading Yes magazine, although Yes is a close second, but it's not it's not the same as seeing it in person.
So Eric, in listening to you talk and reading your chapters, it sounds as if you're really talking about that we intentionally need to degrow our economies, in a sense. Can you talk about that? What might it look like? How might it happen with the least pain? Things like that.
Sure. Yeah. That's one of the topics that I really have tried to study in depth at World Watch, including in last year's report. There's a chapter on that in 2012. And kind of looking at how we intentionally degrow overdeveloped economies rather than waiting for systems to break down, which will kind of push the degrowth process or the economic contraction process in a way that's much more painful, right? I mean, the idea of degrowth is like a controlled diet rather than waiting for starvation to happen. And what that would look like, I mean, one of the case studies in this year's report is actually on Cuba, because Cuba basically had to contract radically and quickly because they suddenly had no access to fossil fuels. And so, because of the embargo plus Soviet Union's collapse. And looking at them as a case study, they were able to maintain high levels of human well-being, a life expectancy on par with the U.S., better infant mortality levels than the U.S. The maternal mortality level in the U.S. is 50th. We're the 50th worst country for maternal mortality. And Cuba, with it's almost a one-planet economy. It's just a little bit over. And with a quarter of the resources that the U.S. uses, has been able to sustain really high levels of education and health for all its citizens, and did that by shifting over through basically degrowing to a much more localized agrarian model. There are something like 30,000 urban garden plots urban gardens with multiple plots in Havana alone, in the city, capital alone. So trying to figure out how we rearrange the infrastructure, how we shift taxes to support more public goods, have more public libraries. So the idea of buying books through Amazon or at this event, sorry, is less and less considered, and we're actually borrowing them for free at libraries or car sharing, or really switching over to much more public goods and equitable distribution of taxes. And ideally, the last one, kind of the redistributing job hours. There was a great New Economics Foundation study that actually took the job hour average of all overworked, underworked, unemployed, and average worker hour in the UK. And they found that the average work week, if all those job hours were equitably distributed, was 21 hours. So if we actually strategically started moving towards a norm, a cultural norm of 20-hour work weeks, people would have the basics. A lot more people would have a basic income to afford basic goods, but fewer people could even afford the luxuries that are part of the consumer marketing hysteria.
Well, speaking of the hysteria, I wondered if we could talk for a couple minutes about the role of corporations in all this. And I think it's a complicated topic. Annie, you've done a bunch of important work shedding light on how corporations mislead consumers. And Eric, you have concerns about the role of corporations, at least in this book, in funding mainstream environmental groups. So is there a role for corporations in making sustainability a reality? And which companies do you think are doing it now and doing it well?
You want to go first?
I can.
Let's do you first, Eric. Sorry to be unclear.
I think there is a role for corporations in promoting sustainability, and I think a number of corporations have been the biggest obstacle. So it's corporations are not a homogenous bunch. Like, I've done a lot of work around toxic chemicals, and there's a small group of people, the Dows, Monsantos, Bayer, DuPont, that actually make the toxic chemicals. those guys are wed to continuing to make them. There are way more corporations that are using the chemicals. Those corporations are not wed to continuing to use these chemicals and would actually be happier to have a non-toxic chemical, because then they don't have to worry about worker health and safety, they don't have to worry about hazardous waste disposal. And so when environmentalists got more sophisticated and stopped saying all corporations are bad and started to differentiate, we found that there's actually a ton of allies within the corporate world that also want to be more sustainable. A lot of them realize there is no business on a dead planet. So there's things like the American Sustainable Business Council that's gotten together to be a business voice for environmental regulations to counter the Chamber of Commerce on Capitol Hill. I'm really excited about some of these. There's the Biz NGO Working Group that are businesses that are really actively finding non-toxic replacements for their alternatives. So I'm very happy about a lot of those sort of signs of progress. But the number one thing when it comes to corporations, when we're talking about sustainability, that we have to talk about is the over-influence of corporations in our democratic process. That is the number one obstacle to advancing sustainable policies, whether it's health, equity, sustainability, anything that you're looking at. The biggest obstacle that will butt your head against the wall very quickly is that corporations own our government. So the number one thing we've got to do is get corporations out of our government and then get citizens back in. And I think that getting corporations into the marketplace instead of democracy is the number one way that corporations can help.
Yeah, that captures 99%, I think. I think the one thing I would add would be that, I mean, right now, with such a... The modern corporation is so trapped into the we-have-to-grow mentality that, you know, they'll never get out of politics, right, until they're forced out.
Until we make them out.
Yeah, absolutely. But they will continue to sell products and expand markets. I mean, there was a recent report on the... and in a positive light, that there will be another billion consumers by 2025. And that's a good thing, because that means more growth and more jobs and more consumption and hooray. But of course, that's accelerating our ecological crash. So finding ways to shift the very purpose of the corporation. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, there's talk about originally, the focus of corporations was to create public benefit, which is arguable. But it could be in the future. The B Corporation, the corporation that actually the first goal is improving society and doing it in a way that makes enough profit to sustain that mission, that's the key evolution of the corporation in the long term.
So, Eric, I just wanted to talk for a minute about environmentalists. And some allies of environmentalists, even on the left, sometimes criticize environmentalists as kind of being zealots or almost religious-like in their fervor about these topics. And it's possible that if someone walked off the street into this conversation now, they might be like, what the hell are you guys talking about? So I'm just, but you take a contrary position in the book. You say that environmentalists should almost embrace more of a religious or at least missionary approach to their work. So I'm wondering if you could tease that out a little bit.
Sure, I'd love to. I think this comes in part because of my background in psychology and religion. That's what I studied. So I kind of had a better exploration of those topics before joining the environmental movement and felt like, and then before being a researcher, I joined a Green Corps, which is an environmental organizing group that really taught me how to canvass. And what success looked like in canvassing was to go to the door, extract as much of a donation as possible, as quickly as possible, so you could get to the next door. And that model is broken. Right, a Mormon missionary at that door would have spent days with that one couple that was expressing interest in Mormonism. Invite them to fellowship, to join a potluck dinner, to become friends with them, so that over time you would build a deeper community. You would bring the pot roast over, or probably a more sustainable choice than that, the vegan casserole over. When they had a new baby and needed extra help or be there for a funeral. And there's a lot of community missing in the environmentalist model. There's also a missing of helping people in their need in the environmentalist model. I call for eco-social services and providing those through the environmentalist movement. That's kind of one of the key points where we should be having eco-clinics in every major city where someone who has diabetes and can't afford insulin goes to a low-income clinic like they do now, but instead of just getting the insulin, there's a fee, you know, and that fee is 10 hours in the eco-clinic community garden, so that they spend that time exercising, being in nature again, reconnecting to real food rather than the processed food that's marketed to them, that's only available in their local convenience store because they're in a food desert, and so on, so that the whole relationship to consumerism is being unraveled through a strong, supportive community that's providing real services in real time, rather than talking about climate change affecting their grandchildren's future.
I mean, there's a good portion of this book where you criticize the environmental movement or environmental groups as often playing defense and not focusing on solutions and just fixing things. I'm wondering, do you think that's a fault of environmental groups, or is that just kind of a challenge of the world we live in right now?
Yes, and that quote that you're referencing is Peter Berg back in the 1980s basically criticizing at the peak of our environmental successes, the Clean Air Campaign, the Clean Water Act, basically saying we're always playing defense. We're fighting a giant war machine that always stays away from our reach, and we're basically field medics picking up the pieces of broken ecosystems after this damage. And it's not that we have to stop campaigning, because we have to continue that role. We have to be field medics while new fracking sites are being developed. But we also have to do it in a way that is building deep power and deep community, so that when that small campaign is achieved, you have a powerful core of people that can be mobilized, like the, you know, the religious communities during civil rights, and be helping to spread a much deeper ecocentric philosophy that hopefully will bring us out of the consumer age, or at least serve as a base or a foundation for a philosophy after the ecological collapse.
Eric Asadorian and Annie Leonard, the co-authors of the book State of the World 2013, Is Sustainability Still Possible? They spoke at Town Hall on September 16th. The talk was moderated by Grist founder Chip Giller. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of the talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at KUOW Speakers. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Eric Asadurian and Annie Leonard in a moment, 943, 94.9, KUOW. Stories of people's brains seemingly leading them astray. Stories of people's brains seemingly leading them astray, knocking them off balance, and sometimes propelling them to do amazing things. For example, a kid whose voice was disguised from himself. Also, a surreal day in the life of a young researcher hijacked by her own brain. And an ultra athlete who, after suffering terrible seizures, gained extraordinary abilities by having a chunk of her brain removed. That's this week's edition of Radiolab, tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. Lows in the 40s tonight, says the forecast. Partly cloudy this evening, then becoming mostly clear. Friday highs lower to mid-60s. Areas of fog in the morning, otherwise sunny skies. Grammy-winning R&B soul singer Aaron Neville performs a set of doo-wop greats, including This Magic Moment and Under the Boardwalk, and duets with Michael Feinstein on Smile, beginning at 10 o'clock.
Hi, this is Don Gagne of NPR News. I'm the national political correspondent these days. And I'm here to remind you that you are the power behind public radio. Listeners like you provide the financial support, and that keeps your favorite programs on the air. Please make your gift today to help keep the fund drive short. It's easy to do by mail or online at kuow.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Eric Asadorian and Annie Leonard are the co-authors of the book State of the World 2013. Is Sustainability Still Possible? They spoke at Town Hall on September 16th. The talk was moderated by Grist founder Chip Giller.
So Annie, at Grist, we spend a lot of time talking about how To some large extent, social media represents almost a democratization of information and a decentralization of information. Stuff can be shared. There don't need to be centralized sources of information. And I see a similar thing going on now in the environmental movement, where there's less change happening in D.C., but across communities across the country and other parts of the world, you're seeing lots of interesting experiments, lots of progress. I'm wondering if you see this as well, and do we have time enough for this decentralized approach to work, or do we need to look at ways to centralize, go back to maybe the model of the 70s and causing environmental change?
Well, we had the centralized, send your donation to the big group in Washington, D.C., and don't do anything model for a number of years, a number of decades, and that clearly did not work. So I'm very hopeful about the decentralization and the sort of re-engagement in this kind of work that the internet can provide and social media can provide. That said, it is not a magic bullet alone. I mean, the reach of social media is incredible and how fast and inexpensively we can contact people. The Story of Stuff film has now been seen by 30 million people. Now, I can talk really fast, but I could not have explained that to 30 million people in my life. There's just no way. So the reach potential is great, but the danger is if people think all they need to do is click on the online petition and then they're done. Some people call that clicktivism or slacktivism. Actually, somebody sent me a book recently because I always make fun of these books about 10 simple things to save the planet. Somebody sent me a book that said, "How to Save the Planet Without Leaving Your Desk." I say the first thing you should do is leave your desk. Yeah. So in terms of the democratization of information, not just information consumption, but information production too. I mean, it used to be to get our story out, we had to pitch, one of a handful of corporate-controlled mega media. Now, a couple of kids in their pajamas in the basement can make a film that can reach everybody in the world. It's amazing. So in terms of democratization of information production, democratization of information sharing, that is great, but we have to not stop there and then get people offline and into their neighborhoods, into their churches, into their schools, sometimes into the streets to start to demand the real change.
Eric, just listening to you and reading the book, I've got to go grim here for a second again. Do you feel like it's too late to cause the type of change we need?
Yeah, the final chapter actually digs into that. Is it too late? if any science fiction fans in the audience, by Kim Stanley Robinson, who is a science fiction writer and really eco-fiction writer, I'd say. But he says it the best, I think, which is, that's a disempowering question, right? Because if you answer, yes, it's too late, then, well, what do? I go home and grab a burger on the way, and it's too late to change anything. But if it's not too late, well, I still have time for a burger. So no matter what, it's the wrong question. So he changes the question to how much are we willing to lose, and then flips that to its positive very quickly to how much will we choose to save? And that's ultimately the question. I mean, the faster we begin, the more of human progress we can save, antibiotics, democracy maybe. But the longer we wait, the more we lose. If we're in a 4-degree world, will democracy survive? Will a population of 7 billion, will we have just a much smaller population around the Arctic bands and Antarctic band? So the question is yes and no. I mean, if it depends on, I mean, we don't want to ask that question at all. We want to say how willing are we to put our life and freedom on the line to make big civic action, to make major cultural changes, to use our personal power, whether we're a teacher and try to change the educational system we're part of or the school we're a part of, whether we're a business person and willing to. I think you sent me a great picture of a local D.C. grocery store where the proprietor ripped out all the bottled water and put a video of the story of bottled water there instead. I mean, those kind of changes, I'm sure he was losing money by making that choice, but in the process he was educating a lot of people about the changes that are needed. So I think the key is not asking that question at all, as Stan Robinson points out, but challenging people to figure out how important a sustainable future is to them and challenging them to act accordingly.
So are you criticizing me for asking that question? No. So if we succeed, will that affect any of us tonight? I mean, what type of time scale are we looking at? Will success happen long after we're gone, or is it something that we would see in the more immediate future? I'll start with you, Eric.
Okay. I think, again, it depends on how bold we act. I mean, success is a gentle transition to a one-planet way of living. So I hope, I mean, I don't blog too much about my toddler, actually. I'm just trying to keep a chronicle of how I'm raising him to survive the 21st century, or more, probably not. At the best case. But, I mean, I think the key is really identifying all the ways that we need to prepare ourselves as a civilization to make it through this ecological transition. I mean, we've locked in 2 degrees, no matter what.
Two degrees Celsius.
So there is going to be major disruptions, and ignoring those by trying to stay too optimistic is bad policy. You know, Chicago is already replanting its street trees for a New Orleans climate, and that's just smart urban planning because they're going to have that in the lifespan of those trees. So thinking strategically about how we get ready for that future is essential.
How about you, Annie? What does success look like, and what type of time frame are you talking about?
I like that concept of a gentle transition because I think it's already happening. I mean, the extreme weather that's happening all around the world, areas around the world that have lost all access to water or fish. We were just chatting before this evening, and I told them I was reading the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, which is a fascinating study of a compilation of thousands of studies about the state of the planet. I just read a new fact in there that was really upsetting to me, which is that if current trajectories continue on fish consumption, all fish populations that are currently harvested for food are going to be gone by 2048. Now, that really hit me hard because I lived in India for some years in fishing villages where every single person in those villages relies on fish for their food and their income. So it's not just no sushi for us in Seattle. It's no food for millions and millions and millions, maybe billions of people. So it's already starting to happen because they're losing access to the fish. Women are having to walk further for access to their water. Weather is totally nuts. And so the transition, that gentle transition, has to already start happening. And it is happening as well. The fastest growing sector of the food business right now is farmer markets. There's an explosion of sharing. Sharing is getting so popular. I don't know if you've seen this here in Seattle, but there's a new name for it, collaborative consumption, formerly known as sharing, where people are learning to look to each other, to their community, to meet their needs rather than the economy. Some journalist called me the other day and said, if you had $1,000 to invest in a more sustainable future, what would you do? I said, I'd have a neighborhood dinner at my house on the first Sunday of the month for 10 months. Because if you know your neighbors, if you get to know your neighbors and build that community, when you're in the middle of baking a cake and you ran out of eggs, you don't have to drive to the store. You can just go next door. When you need a power drill, do you know how much the average power drill is used in its entire lifetime in this country? 15 minutes. That is it. We do not all need to own a power drill and a creme brulee torch and a bundt pan and, you know, ski gear and all this stuff. We can share. So we can hasten this gentle transition towards sustainability by getting to know our neighbors, by sharing, by finding meaning in social fabric and community activities rather than stuff. We could already start it.
So I feel like one legacy of the 20th century environmental movement was, unfortunately, kind of this image of an environmentalist as something of a self-righteous person or a scold. And so I'm wondering, when you're talking to people in your networks or your families, your friends, how do you convey that this question of sustainability isn't just a niche issue, that it's a concern that affects us all? And how do you talk about these issues effectively well? I mean, I think you guys are giving evidence of this now, but what I'm looking for are tips for those of us here, those of us in the audience, so that people can go out and act as missionaries. So why don't we start with you, Eric?
Well, it's an awkward question because I am an environmentalist scold. I have to admit, I mean, I actually polarized even my colleagues by using the term degrowth at World Watch. I mean, it doesn't sell well, right? It's not a good marketing choice. But I think my niche is probably more trying to radicalize those that are really going to act. I don't want people to change their shopping bags as much as really take significant action. And there's even a chapter this year on resistance and what does that entail? We need to start having those conversations for seriously. I also have family that has no idea what I do for a living, even though I've explained it to them 100 times, and I've tried to find that softer message. It is about well-being. At the end of the day, the reframing of sustainability around well-being is probably the most positive frame, right? The idea that we don't have to work 60 hours or even 40 hours a week, but we should have maternal leave and paternal leave and guaranteed vacation and sick days and really re-engineer our consumer culture to be, to prioritize well-being, both of human beings and the planet. And I think that is probably the best seller that I've found, that people want more time for them, their families, their communities, for their leisure activities, and so they're willing to kind of make quote-unquote sacrifices, which aren't sacrifices at all. I mean, working less is something many would do.
Got it. How about you, Annie?
Well, I think one of the most important steps in talking about these issues is listening first before you start to talk. I once heard that when Gandhi was in South Africa and he was moving back to India to start his political campaigning, his guru, his teacher in South Africa, told him, don't voice an opinion for a year. Just go back to India for a year and listen. Now, I don't think we should not voice an opinion for a year because we're in a bit of a rush here. But I think it's really important to listen. If we listen and then we screen for commonalities, we can find entree points with almost everybody on the planet. I mean, it turns out most people would like the global climate to stay in that temperature range in which human life can continue. And most people would like their babies born without toxic chemicals. I, for many years, was a self-righteous environmentalist, and I would screen for differences. I was like, you eat red meat, I won't talk to you. You know, your husband works or your father worked for Dow Chemical, I won't talk to you. If you screen for differences, you're going to be really lonely. But if you screen for commonality, almost every single person shares the same general values. The way I like to look at the world is, here's everybody. We got 20% in this room, already on board, buy these books, like totally with us, already active. We got 20% never going to get on board, absolutely refuse to understand science. Then we got 60% generally share our concerns but are not active. That last 20%, just let them go. Just ignore them. We have 80% of the people who generally share our concerns. If we can connect with them and move them from a place of generally sharing our concerns to active for change, that's enough people to change the rules of the game. And then that last 20% is going to have to get with the program because it's the new program. It's going to be the new default. So that's my thing, is look for commonalities, listen and find avenues to bring these issues in about something that the person is already interested in rather than just bombarding them. I just want to tell a quick story here. I for those of you who know me, there's a lot of people who know me in this room, I really hate garbage incinerators, and I have fought garbage incinerators for about 20 years. So I was at a dinner party a couple of years ago, and this guy comes up to me and says, I heard you know a lot about garbage incinerators. I was like, this is a dream come true. I was like, blah, 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 just laying it on. And then I look over and I see my next door neighbor, Andre, that some of you know, cracking up in the corner. He had told this guy, you want to see something funny? Go ask that woman about garbage incinerators. And I said, you know, the point in which you are the butt of dinner party jokes by your loved ones is time to change your communication habits. Yeah.
Annie Leonard and Eric Ossadorian, the co-authors of the book State of the World 2013, Is Sustainability Still Possible? They spoke at Town Hall on September 16th. The talk was moderated by Grist founder Chip Giller. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of the talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at kuowspeakers. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, committed to innovative ways to keep cows comfortable with bedding, cushioned walkways, misters, and nutritional and medical care. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com. 10 o'clock, KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham. I'm Bill O'Grady.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.